Click kaya959.co.za
to download the Kaya Biz podcast.
We're getting down to business, all right? You're listening to Kaya Biz here on Kaya959 with myself, Gugulethu Mfuphi. Lots on the agenda. And can you believe we're officially starting to wind down the month of November? Guys, the year has flown. I think I said this in October, but now in November, it's starting to get real. It's starting to get real, real. But happy to hear your thoughts, your comments, and your feedback. This coming Friday, we are headed to see Black Friday take place. Many of us would be well aware that Black Friday was actually a U.S. retail holiday. During this time of the year in the U.S., they celebrate Thanksgiving, a traditional holiday all about family, remembrance, and of course, camaraderie and collaboration. And typically after the Thanksgiving holiday, that's where there would be a retail sale known as Black Friday, where discounts would be offered, significant discounts, that is, to a large number of consumers within wide varieties of retail stores. Since then, it's garnered a lot of attention, gained a lot of prospects and experience in South Africa. And what we did see is that a few South African retailers started launching this pre-COVID around 2017, perhaps even earlier. And that's actually where we saw it growing in the country. There were days when South Africans would actually queue for hours on end at stores like Game, even Macro, and so many others to buy new phones, technology, and essentially make sure that they're able to access some discounts. I stand under correction. Black Friday as a retail holiday was actually imported into South Africa back in 2012. And Checkers, as a business, often lays claim to starting Black Friday in South Africa, which they say they launched back in 2014. Interesting, right? But as we know, a large number of retailers have followed through with this theme. COVID came, and then we all kind of got a reality check as to which particular discounts we need to prioritize in our lives. And it wasn't always about the flat screen TV. It was just about the basics. Making sure you've got toilet paper, buy it in bulk. Making sure you've got nappies for the children, buy them in bulk. Making sure you've got all your cleaning supplies and even household goods that you might need for the year ahead instead of waiting for the January rush. Wow, is that what we're still doing as South Africans? It's a question that we'll answer, but also we want you to share your thoughts and your feedback. This coming Friday, are you participating in the splurge? We want to know. Or maybe you've already scouted your deals. You are making sure you keep to your budget. Or maybe you might be sometimes like I am, but not this time around, swayed by the texts, the messages and the emails, all that promotional activity that you see, the promotional marketing that we see from many retailers. Are you putting your hands in your pockets and saying thank you, bye? Or are you saying, might as well spoil myself with this one? Well, let us know. You can share your voice notes on 063-688-0959. But beyond that, when you do spend money that you might be borrowing from your bank through the form of a credit card or maybe using a buy now, pay later service, there is one critical theme you need to make sure you prioritize. Paying that money back and on time. Otherwise, it will consequently have a significant outcomes on your credit score. And that is essentially something that can be viewed as defaulting or missing particular payments over an extended period of time. And as a result, essentially means that next time the banks want to loan you money, they look at you and they say, your track record shows that you don't keep to the agreement. You perhaps dilly-dally, flip-flop, and don't always keep to the commitment in terms of paying timeously. That is the secret to improving your credit score. Pay on time. Pay the minimum amount, if not more, and make sure that you pay regularly. If not, if you can, make sure that you kill the debt. Do that because it actually helps you in terms of showing the bank that you are a reliable partner in actually making use of credit. I sound like a financial advisor, but please bear in mind, this is not financial advice. This is just some of the feedback that I hear from many of my friends, and it's friends who know what they're doing. So use it, don't use it. One good friend that I thoroughly enjoy speaking to, I learned so much from this young gent who's joining us on the line tonight to help us understand so much about the key themes of the Experian Consumer Default Index. Now, this is essentially a measure that is designed to measure the rolling default behavior that we as South African consumers have. So what kind of loans we have, when we pay them off, do we pay them off on time, or do we still dilly-dally and delay? A good friend is going to tell us that. Head of Strategy and Innovation at Experian Africa, Jaco van Jaarsveld. Jaco, welcome back to the show. Always lovely to have you.
I always love coming here because I'm called young, and the only time I'm ever called young is on this show. So please have me back every night.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for that error. Oh, man, it's on my script.
No, it's not an error. It's an absolute, absolute compliment. That's why I love coming here.
Oh, I'm glad.
You're stroking my ego.
I'm glad. I see some sunshine outside your window. Are you in South Africa or somewhere else here, Yaku?
It's Cape Town. Oh, the sun only goes down after 8 in Cape Town.
Completely forgot. Ah, you're living the life. But on that note, we're going to talk about a very interesting theme, and it's one that really gets me excited because, again, it helps us take a look at what's happening inside our behavior as South Africans when it comes to our pockets, but also what we do with the money in our pockets. And maybe let's just start off with a better understanding of the Experian Consumer Default Index and what it essentially measures. Our behavior, tracking the time, but help us understand what it helps us walk away with in terms of the knowledge and insight.
So in simple terms, what the Experian Consumer Default Index measures is the increase in the rate of first payment default for consumers defaulting for the first time ever. So it's basically an early indicator of distress in the market. So the higher the index, the more people are defaulting. And when I say defaulting, they're reaching a delinquency state of 90 days plus in arrears. So 3 months or more in arrears on an account for the first time ever. And an improving index when it reduces is an indication that fewer people are defaulting for the first time ever. So in general, what it means, as we've seen in the numbers from last quarter to this quarter, or even year on year, we've seen a significant improvement in the consumer default index, which if you look at it from a pure numbers perspective, should mean that people are defaulting less, and therefore we're seeing the South African consumer in a better financial position than they were last year. However, there's a number of factors that influences the consumer default index. Mm-hmm. So demand and supply of credit, especially supply of credit, has a direct impact on that consumer default index as well. If you don't supply credit, fewer people by definition will default because they just don't have credit. If you're not issuing credit, people can't default on it. If you only issue credit to the very top end of the market that has the lowest risk and therefore the higher probability of paying back, then you will have an improving default index. So you need to look at it from multiple aspects. Is it because of consumer performance improving? Unfortunately, it's not. It is 100% aligned to the lack of supply in the market. Now, credit demand and supply is a very interesting topic that I love to discuss with people. And structurally, credit supply has changed from pre-COVID to post-COVID.
Yeah.
And that has had a detrimental impact on a very large portion of the South African population, not having access to credit.
Yes.
Purely because credit is focused on the top end of the market. So when you look at it from our financial affluent segment perspective, it's your top three segments, your luxury living, aspirational achievers and labored living. They are the ones that actually continue to gain easy access to credit, where your money conscious majority, labored living and yearning youth, the supply has basically dried up.
Exactly.
And as a result, the majority of the population have access to very little credit, and the minority of the credit active population, 12 to 18% of the market, holds over 90% of the debt. And post-COVID, all the banks have done is they play it safe. They target, and it makes perfect sense. Commercially, it makes sense. They have shareholders to manage returns from a share perspective. They can't let their impairments go up. They've got the Reserve Bank from a liquidity perspective, having a very tight look in terms of, from a Basel perspective, what the in terms of capital adequacy ratios, etc. So you can understand where it comes from. But as a result, structurally, there's less supply in the market and fewer people actually benefiting from credit.
100%.
Which is not a good thing.
Got you. I'm so glad that you took us on this journey to fully understand it, because I was going to lead with the next question to say, well, the numbers look good, but is it really good? And you've given us context that despite the fact that we do see this 14% year-on-year improvement in the overall CDI index for the third quarter, or if we look at it quarter-on-quarter, it's moved from 4.36% in June to 3.76%. But as you're saying, it just essentially means that a lot more people who typically had the flexibility to go to the bank and say, hey, just the 10,000 rand here, the bank is more likely likely to say, Googs, you don't really qualify for the 10. At best, we can give you 3, maybe 5. And we also see that within the bank's financial results, because their credit loss ratios have also come down significantly as a result, seeing them produce higher profit. What I am quite keen to also understand, though, as you say, especially in the different segments, despite the fact that we do see higher income earnings still qualifying for credit, they themselves, though, are still under pressure. So I drive my fancy German car. I stay in a beautiful 3-bedroom house in the suburb, but there are some times when I might default on my credit card payment to make up for other payments. Is my assessment correct of the study here?
100% correct. The most financially distressed segment in the market for the last 24 months, actually for a bit more than 24 months, is your luxury living and aspirational achievers, those that have access to credit. And the reason for that is with the banks shifting towards focusing on those that had credit before, because if you think about it from a credit risk management perspective, if I've given you credit before, I know how you're managing your credit and I can clearly see you're paying your accounts very well, and therefore I'm comfortable to give you more credit. But not only one bank that you have your home loan with or your previously your credit card with is doing that. You've got the other banks going in and saying, well, I need to also find new customers, so I'm also going to go after that customer that is with Bank A. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen is a significant increase in multi-bank consumers, especially in the most affluent segments, the luxury living and aspirational achiever segment of the market. That is where we've seen multi-bank consumers increase significantly. What we then looked at is that we look at, well, consumers that's multi-bank versus single bank. What's the consumer default index relative between those two? And the consumer default index for multi-bank consumers is double that of the, compared to those with a single bank account.
No ways.
And it's a clear indication. And then we went on, hold on a second, why are more people getting multi-bank? Because they need credit. Mm. And now what we've seen is the credit card limits on multi-bank customers, or over the last year, 2 years, we've seen it increase by 30 to 40% increase in credit card limits to the same customers. Mm. And commensurate utilization has gone up to the same level. So people have got higher limits. And remember, when you target, when the banks typically target these customers, it's not a credit card limit of 10,000 or 20,000 Rand. It's 100, 150,000 Rand limits. It's personal loans of 100 to 200,000 Rand. Now imagine you're having multiple personal loans or multiple credit cards of 200,000 Rand, 100,000 Rand across multiple banks. And now you have to juggle and manage all these. You still only have the same salary.
Yaki, you're mentioning such an important point, right? Because we've seen the banks becoming very aggressive in terms of their marketing. And I know a number of people who are multi-banked. I am too. What I'm intrigued by, though, is if there isn't a heightened level of financial literacy to actually utilize, number one, the minimum payment periods at a 0% interest rate, specifically on a credit card, but also how South Africans are using them to link them to the rewards programs of some of these banks, because often that's been a big incentive to drive usage as well as customer growth.
Absolutely. Now, especially when you start looking at banks with very strong loyalty programs, yes, they're the banks with the highest proportion of single bank customers. So there's a direct correlation between the value of a loyalty program and the rate of single bank customers. And when you go look at those loyalty programs, for instance, you can clearly see that the loyalty program is structured around the wants and needs of consumers, mm-hmm, number one. And number two, those loyalty programs is almost treated as another form of cash flow. Mm-hmm. And that cash flow comes through whether it's real cash back or whether it's a form of cash back. I don't want to call, I don't want to say the name of a specific bank. Just now, I think I favor them. But the loyalty program, single bank customers are far better in terms of managing their financials than people with single banks, number one. Mm. Number two, it's a single monthly fee. You don't pay multiple monthly fees. Mm-hmm. And three, the benefit of the loyalty program on one set of transactions is far greater than you having to juggle transactions across multiple accounts, which brings us to the point, well, why are people multi-bank? Well, they take it because they need it. And then they default higher because it's a need, it's a financial need. And that then goes straight back to the correlation in terms of those segments that have access to credit are the most distressed. And we see the consumer default index in those segments deteriorating way faster than the consumer's default index, for instance, in the labored living, yearning youth, etc. But in the labored living, yearning youth, and money-conscious majority, the reason that they aren't seeing a deterioration in CDI is not because they pay their accounts better. They don't have access to credit. And unfortunately, as per our previous conversation a month or so ago, they need money still because the credit demand is far higher than it was pre-COVID. But the supply is significantly lower. So there's a need for credit. They're not getting it from the credit providers.
Yes.
So they go elsewhere. Now they go back to the informal machinisa market or in some instances, sadly, they start gambling, the online gambling situation. You can see that happening. And we saw it in the analytics we did previously where those segments of the market, your money-conscious majority, labor living and earning youth, can spend between 30 and 50% of their monthly income on gambling. And then we looked at it and thought, well, that doesn't make sense. And the more you start unpacking this, the one thing that is still unknown, but one can theoretically draw a correlation is where are we seeing this biggest two-pot system withdrawals? And we're busy with a detailed research into that, which we hope to release early in the year when we've got sufficient proof of it. But the hypothesis is no credit, therefore I need to find money elsewhere, therefore I'm drawing down on my retirement funds. And
but there's limits and tax implications there too, right? So I'm assuming that's then what pushes them to say, well, why not just try gambling where my chances might be higher?
Yeah. And again, we're not for 1 second saying people are doing it for that reason, but you can see it's the increased rate of gambling in the lower, in your three lowest fare segments. And theoretically, we're having a look to see where that the majority of this one two-pot system withdrawals are. I think the crux, however, is that structurally we have a problem. We have a severe problem. And structurally, it's not going to get fixed because pre-COVID, the predominant lenders to the lower end of the market or your entry-level credit customers was clothing retailers. And the clothing retailers in those days, I'll never forget, it was said, this is a scourge, clothing retailers get people in trouble. But we proved that out of every 10 people pre-COVID that applied for credit, that started their credit journey, 4 out of 10, so 40% started with a clothing retail account. Of those, 80% went on to banking products. So they migrated to better products because they learned to manage credit, small limits, 12-month accounts or 6-month accounts, very small limits, gradually improve, pay. You're obviously going to get those that default, but the default rates were way lower. The clothing retailers were able to take on a lot more risk due to the fact that they had far bigger margins than a bank and they could fund some of the losses through their clothing margin. Mm-hmm. So that was actually the start of people's credit journey, started with clothing retailers. Post-COVID, the retailers, unfortunately, and I was in retail at the time, pre-COVID, got drunk on the revenue that we earned out of financial services. And it wasn't the credit revenue. It was all the insurance products we sold on top of the credit revenue and the club revenue and all of that. And then you looked at this and you went over R1 billion in revenue out of financial services when you're only doing 500 million in clothing sales. And you go, the mix is wrong here. I'm a retail clothing. I sell clothes and I make more money out of credit. Doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense. So, but it was difficult to get off that drug. COVID got them off the drug very quickly. Clothing retailers didn't have online shopping immediately available, and the credit drug disappeared because I couldn't get people in store anymore. What they did very cleverly, though, is they got off the drug and they adjusted to the new generation of shoppers where you went from 3 seasons in a year to 4 seasons in a year because you've got fast fashion players like Temu, et cetera, in the market. Mm. And if clothing retailers aren't adjusting to that fast fashion, which they need a strong cash on balance sheet available to do it, and therefore they stop lending on the credit side. And that gap has not been taken up by anybody. Nobody has come in. And unfortunately, the consumer is the one that struggles. We've got a consumer that needs a starting point for credit. And unless we figure out how we're going to do that, we've got a problem.
Got you. This is so critical. Yaku, I could talk to you all day. You've just given us a lesson into the ecosystem of financial management or money or financial inclusion and how retailers have played a bigger role in it. And there have been some winners and some losers. I know you can't mention company names, but I will. This is where the likes of Pepco have seen some great successes, hence now moving into owning a bank and authority from the Prudential Authority. We've seen the likes of Mr. Price, though, the Fashini Group, actually on the opposite end saying, this credit spend is not something that's actually sustainable within the South African market? This might be an unfair question, but I think is valid given the timing of the year. We ahead of Black Friday, the festive season, back to school in Jan. We've just had the inflation rate reduced to 3%, the target for the MPC as well as National Treasury. And we saw an interest rate cut just 2 weeks ago from the MPC themselves. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but are these some of the factors, though, that might contribute to a shift in our financial behavior as South African consumers, specifically for those who do have access to credit at the moment?
It's going to take consumers to make the change. If a consumer needs to decide not to spend the money in order to manage their finances. If you think of those that's multi-bank, that's taken these higher credit limits but have commensurately increased the utilization, their installments have gone massively up.
Mm.
And what, in order to bring those installments down and to get financially, improve your financial wellness, you're going to have to take this benefit and reduced interest rates and the cost savings from a slower inflationary environment and use it to pay down debt.
Yeah.
And that is basically the message before Black Friday. Now, people always ask me, what do you tell people before Black Friday? I say, I don't tell people, I tell my kids, I tell my daughters, they're 24 and 21, because if I can convince them, other people will listen.
True.
And I struggle to convince my daughters not to get caught up in the Black Friday hype. And to me, that is the key thing. It's an individual decision. So hopefully this year they don't spend as much or they spend less, but that's the message. If I can get my kids or the young generation to figure out, do not get caught in the hype and rather use the benefits of the savings to reduce your exposure and your credit exposure.
Yes.
And manage it better. But again, that's the people that benefit from an interest rate environment.
Yeah.
The majority of South Africans, they don't care about interest rate because they're so limited exposure to interest-bearing debt. For them, it's just day-to-day living.
Mm.
And I don't think that segment of the market has the luxury. We talk Black Friday. There's a massive segment of the market that don't even have the luxury to access this Black Friday craze. They just can't.
True.
And that, to me, is the structural problem in South Africa. And the biggest single problem that we have in South Africa is employment. And the only way we fix this is creating employment. And I know there was also the debate in terms of the informal market. There's a lot of people employed there and unemployment rates being 10% and not 32.1%. The unemployment rate's in between the two. It's certainly not as high as 31, but maybe not as low as 10. It's somewhere in between because the informal economy is enormous. However, there's a small formal economy where small businesses, there's a 350 billion rand funding gap where small businesses just cannot access credit because, again, structurally, the market prohibits them from getting the money. There's more than ample supply. Money is a commodity. There's more than ample money available, but the matching of demand and supply doesn't exist. And to me, that is the crux. If we can fix that access to finance, especially turnovers of companies with turnovers less than a million looking for funding of less than 250,000.
Yes.
There's a million of them out there, small loans. They just need to go from, they have on average between 3 and 5 employees, including the owners. If we can just take them to 6, 7, 8 employees, we fundamentally change employment and we fundamentally change access to credit because now people can lend because they qualify from an affordability perspective. And now we kickstart the credit market. So unless we're not going to kickstart the credit market by saying to the banks, you need to take more risk.
Mm.
Well, a person needs to be employed to lend to.
Exactly.
The regulation says so. Create employment. But to create employment, make that funding gap between demand and supply. We need to make it easier and less stringent and bureaucratic for small business to access finance.
Got you. Yaku, you're speaking my language here because I think many of us as entrepreneurs who have started on that journey experience that, right, in the foundations phases of growing our entities. Something that I have witnessed, though, whether it's for a consumer, but even more so for entrepreneurs, is the conundrum of how to, number one, leverage credit, using it wisely to actually grow your credit profile in showing the banks or other institutions that you can pay at a favor consistently. And then others who actually are too scared to access more credit and trying to just remain disciplined because you don't want to get yourself into a financial conundrum. That's often the juxtaposition and the conundrum that many people find themselves in, right? So how do we manage that? And maybe given that you work at Experian, you see that dynamic in those who do it well and those who are actually just too scared to get their foot in the water.
Yeah, so the key thing is the majority of the real growth is going to come from small businesses that turn over less than a million a year. That's where the majority, the bulk of the small business demand is coming from. And the supply on above a million, above 5 million, there's plenty supply. It's easy to supply a business with 5 million plus turnover because they've got management accounts, etc. Less than a million turnover, only 15% of them have management accounts and 10% of them have payroll systems.
Mm.
So they don't have management accounts and therefore they can't access it. So we need to look at it very differently. We need to change how we look at it. And it's not just the small business, it's the lenders. The lenders need to change the way they look at them.
Mm.
Under 250,000 Rand loans, such a loan is treated as a consumer. It's not even a small business loan. If you're asking for less than 250, turning over less than a million, you fall under the National Credit Act as a consumer.
Oh.
So anybody that wants that, just your personal profile is critical.
Yeah.
Because that's what you will be getting money against. They judge you on your personal or the directors of the business's personal profiles.
Yes.
The moment you go above 250,000 Rand, then you treat it as a small business. Then you need things like management accounts, etc. So spend some time doing those things. But from a business perspective, what we're doing as Experian in partnership with a phenomenal company called FinFind is creating the capability that will automatically generate such payment management accounts, etc. In terms of making access to finance simpler. And what we've created along with FinFind is we've created a solution that matches demand and supply better.
Uh-huh.
But in order to match demand and supply, the middle bit from a demand side, we're helping the demand side get to a point where we can advise them whether they're going to be funding ready or not before they go ask the credit question. Because a lot of the declines, and there's a big thing. I learned a brilliant lesson in Kayamandi and in Deep Sewer.
Mm-hmm.
We launched a consumer app. And we built a consumer app and very excitedly walked in there and told the people in Deep Sewer and Kayamandi, the community, and there was a lot of hustlers, young startups and brilliant, most amazing kids I've ever met in my life, running 5 businesses on the side, brilliant. And that's why when people say to me, we need to trust me, the youngsters of today know how to hustle. They know how to run a business. We just need to get them the money to grow these businesses.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. But I got there and I said, we've got this and we're going to do A, B, C, D, and E. And the lady stopped me. She said, all you need to do is help me answer the question, the credit question, before I go ask it. Take the embarrassment factor and the decline, the feeling of being declined for credit out of the question. So if you're going to provide me a solution, let that solution tell me you're going to qualify yes or no before I go ask. And if I'm not going to, tell me what I need to do to improve it.
Mm.
So we launched the consumer app to do just that. And now we're working with FinFind to launch a business application app that tells you whether you're funding ready or not before you actually start applying. And when we determine, yes, you are funding ready, we will match you with supply, where we say from a credit supply perspective, all credit providers, tell us explicitly what type of business you're looking for. So I'm not going to get an applicant to go apply at 20 places or at the wrong place. I'm going to make sure that I match demand and supply to get that successful access to credit successful and thereby creating the employment we so desperately need to kickstart the credit economy. And the credit economy is a good thing. It's a good thing. You need a strong credit economy.
Exactly. It is, because it also speaks to not only the performance of the economy, but I mean, the credit economy is something that also works in terms of, you know, sovereign debt and access.
Yes.
So there's an interlink in terms of the flow of money and using credit correctly, especially when it comes to leveraging it as an asset for further growth. And you've touched on so many examples here, Yaku. You're tickling my brain cells, and you can tell I don't want to let you go. I'm on the FinFind website and I do see what you mean. It does essentially take away that embarrassment to say, well, I don't know how to search for funding. I don't know if I'll qualify. I don't know what to prepare. So just holding the hand of an entrepreneur to say, this is how you manage your management accounts, this is how to interpret your financial statements, this is how to draft your projections to also understand how you'll allocate this capital and where the growth will come from. You've touched on so many points here, Yaku, and we're definitely going to get you back. I guess before we close off, as you've said, credit is important, but it's in the management of that credit. And I think it's important for us to underscore this and emphasize this in terms of making sure that you have a healthy credit profile. It's all fundamentally based on your behavior when it comes to the repayment terms and conditions, right?
Absolutely, and own it. Don't be afraid of it. Yeah. It's your data. And the great thing with accessing your credit profile, again, that's why we created the app that we built as Experian called Up. It's free credit score, free credit report forever, a budgeting facility, education around how to manage your credit, what a credit bureau is. There's a lot of misunderstanding what a credit bureau is, and they see a credit bureau as the place that blacklists you. Mm-hmm. A credit bureau does nothing of the sorts. A credit bureau is a holder of information that is converted into a decision. And that information is your personal behavioral data on management of your accounts reflected all in one place. The best thing consumers can do is go and get your credit report, go and get your credit score and start understanding how it works. Go check your credit report, because the most important thing, especially even from a fraud and an identity theft perspective, if you own your credit report and you go through it in detail, you can see whether there's any funny business going on there, and you've got the right to fix it. And once you fix it, keep an eye on it every single month, because fraudsters will use your details, and those details pops up on your credit report. You can very quickly go, this is not my data. Plus, there's value-added services, like if any of your data is used on the dark web, you'll be notified that we've picked up some of your data on the dark web. Be cautious, change your password, do this, etc. So own it. Don't be afraid of it. It's your data.
100%. Yaku, I could talk to you all day, sir. And thanks for making references to the data as well as understanding the psychology of Black Friday. I do see those articles as well also up on your website. So for anyone who's just caught the tail end of this conversation, do make sure that you visit app.experian.co.za, and you can get more details around just preparing yourself. This Friday, if you don't have to, put your hands in your pockets, act like you didn't see the discount, especially if it's for something you didn't need, and keep it moving. Yaku van Jaarsveld, Head of Strategy and Innovation at Experian Africa. Thank you again for your time, sir.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. Look forward to chatting soon, and have a fantastic Christmas.
Likewise. Have a good one.
Don't spend too much on Black Friday.
I promise I won't. Always a blast speaking to Yaku, as you've heard. It's just before 7:30, but I want to hear from you too. So do be sure to share your thoughts, your comments, and your feedback. We want to hear your voice notes as well. Are you spending on Black Friday or doing things differently this time around? Have you been doing them differently? And if you are someone who does have multiple credit cards, yes, there's nothing wrong with that. But are you using it correctly? Are you paying them off on time? Are you taking advantage of the benefits of actually having these kinds of access to credit linked to some kind of rewards and loyalty program? Yep, it's important. I ran over with this conversation, but I think my team will forgive me.
Click kaya959.co.za
to download the Kaya Biz podcast.